account for the massive output of carbon emissions by the U.S. military. Germany hosts the Secretariat of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. In June, as a prelude to COP27, the UN held a conference in Bonn on climate change. The talks ended in acrimony over the finance for what is known as loss and damage. The European Union consistently blocked all discussions on compensation. Eddie Press of the Climate Action Network in Canada said, "Consumed by their narrow interests, rich nations, and in particular countries in the European Union, came to the Bonn Climate Conference to block, delay, and undermine efforts from people and communities on the front lines addressing the losses and damage caused by fossil fuels. On the table is the hypocrisy of countries such as Germany, which claims to lead on these issues, but instead has been sourcing fossil fuels overseas and has been spending increasing funds on its military. At the same time, these countries have denied support to developing countries, facing devastation from climate-induced superstorms and rising seas. After the recent German elections, hopes were raised that the new coalition of the Social Democrats with the Green Party would lift up the green agenda. However, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has promised 100 billion euros for the military, the biggest increase in the country's military expenditure since the end of the Cold War. He has also committed to spending more than 2% of the country's gross domestic product on the military. This means more money for the military and less money for climate mitigation and green transformation. The money that is being poured into the Western military establishments does not only drift away from any climate spending, but also promotes greater climate catastrophe. The U.S. military is the largest institutional polluter on the planet. The maintenance of its more than 800 military bases around the world, for instance, means that the U.S. military consumes 395,000 barrels of oil daily. In 2021, the world's governments spent $2 trillion on weapons, with the leading country being those that are the richest, as well as the most sanctimonious on the climate debate. Money is available for war, but not to deal with the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi wrote, "The way weapons have poured into Ukraine conflict gives many of us pause." According to the Hunger Hotspots report by the United Nations agencies, the prolongation of that war has placed 49 million more people at risk of famine in 46 countries. Conflict and organized violence were the main sources of food insecurity in Africa and West Asia, specifically in northern Nigeria, Central Sahel, Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan, Yemen, and Syria. The conflict in Eastern Europe has exacerbated the food crisis by driving up the price of agricultural commodities. Russia and Ukraine together account for around 30% of the global wheat trade. So the longer the conflict continues, the more hunger hotspots will grow, taking food insecurity beyond just Africa and West Asia. While one COP meeting has already taken place on the African continent, another will take place this year. First, Abidjan hosted the UN Convention to Combat Desertification in May, and then Sharm el-Sheikh will host the UN Climate Change Conference. These are major forums for African states to put on the table the great damage done to parts of the continent due to the climate catastrophe. Murad Qureshi concluded, "When the representatives of the countries of the world gather at Sharm el-Sheikh in November for COP27, They will hear Western representatives talk about climate change, make pledges, and do everything possible to continue to exacerbate the catastrophe. What we saw in Bonn is a prelude to what will be a fiasco in Sharm el-Sheikh.
Saudi ties with the United States. Part 1.
Well, the long classified pages detailing alleged ties of the Saudi Arabian government to the 9/11 hijackers have now been released by Congress.
They confirm what many have suspected all along, that the 9/11 hijackers...
15 years after the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. government finally released the long-classified parts of an official report on an inquiry into its intelligence community activities before and after the attacks. Those parts were 28 out of hundreds of pages that provided details about the incident and results of the inquiry. According to these 28 pages, a number of officials of the Saudi embassy in Washington and its affiliated institutes had close ties with people involved in hijacking commercial planes and crashing them into the World Trade Center in New York City. The officials had helped the hijackers travel, reside, study, and even receive driving education in the U.S. 15 out of 19 people who carried out the 9/11 attacks were Saudi citizens. But for everyone, especially the families of the victims, it was very strange that what made different American administrations, from Democrat to Republican, act so cautiously in this regard. Years on, those families, as well as journalists and observers, are still confused about such stance. It seems strange for everyone that where this bond began and how it grew that has granted such immunity to Saudi Arabia, whose relationship still continues with the U.S. despite the fact that thousands of Americans were killed in the 9/11 attacks. The Saudi story begins in this city. Today, Riyadh is a modern city with very beautiful buildings as well as wide and long highways. Images of the king and the young crown prince can be seen everywhere. A crown prince who's an exception in the 100-year history of the Saudi royal family. No one has so far got the chance to acquire this position at this age. Of course, everything was different in the days when Al Saud decided to conquer this city to expand its rule all over the region that today is known as Saudi Arabia. In those days, different tribes were living in Najd and Hejaz regions, which were fighting for their survival, and Al Saud was one of those tribes. Abdulaziz bin Abdulrahman bin Saud was the one who decided to wage a war in the early years of the 20th century. To fulfill his dreams, he needed a sword that could defeat all tribes, and at that time, this sword belonged to the Brotherhood. The Brotherhood was the name of a group of people who were staunch followers of Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab.
They were very warlike and merciless, and that was exactly what Al Saud needed.
The bond between Al Saud and Abdul Wahhab, which existed for more than 100 years, had become stronger and helped Abdul Aziz conquer Riyadh in 1902. The conflict continued until a few years after the end of the First World War, and Abdulaziz declared his rule on the entire Saudi Arabia in 1926 after defeating Hejaz ruler Sharif Hussein. Al Saud felt indebted to the brotherhood whose position was increasingly improving in this family. In 1932, Abdulaziz bin Saud put the name of his clan on a country that today we know as Saudi Arabia and officially declared its existence. Several years after Abdulaziz took power in Saudi Arabia, the number of pilgrims of Hajj, which was one of the main sources of income for the Saudi ruler, began to decrease due to a global financial crisis that erupted in the U.S. In 1929, the number of Hajj pilgrims was about 130,000, which was reduced to 40,000 2 years later. The financial situation of Abdulaziz was so bad in those days that he told one of his American friends, Philby, that he would give any concessions to anyone giving him ₹1 million. Al Saud had come to power with the help of the merciless Brotherhood and apparently needed them to survive. But the Saudi royal family had to find a new way to pay the country's expenses, and at that time, oil was the best solution. In the early 1930s, many countries were trying to sign contracts with the Al Saud that was already in possession of vast oil resources. During that time, there was stiff competition between British and American companies for taking oil exploration patents. Finally, on May 29, 1933, and after weeks of negotiations with Saudi officials, representatives of the American company Standard Oil of California signed a contract with the Saudi king for the oil exploration in Saudi Arabia. American experts began exploring oil in the heat of scorching deserts of Saudi Arabia, and in 1938, and after 5 years of exploring, they gained their first achievement in Dammam area, a few kilometers north of the city of Dahran and at the seventh drilling site. But the beginning of the story of the U.S. and Al Saud family dates back to the final days of the Second World War. That's when then-U.S. President Franklin Roosevelt was returning from the Yalta Conference on the Crimean Peninsula. There, he, along with British Prime Minister Winston Churchill and Soviet Premier Joseph Stalin, had shared the spoils of war, especially in Europe, several days before.
When USS Quincy, the ship carrying Roosevelt, reached the Suez Canal, it made a short stop at Bitter Lake so that he could meet with a number of Arab and African leaders, the most important of whom was Abdulaziz bin Saud, the king of the newly established country of Saudi Arabia. A warship had gone to Jeddah to bring Abdulaziz to the Suez Canal. Abdulaziz had told everyone that he was heading for Mecca, and until the last moment, nobody knew that the destination was the pier of Jeddah. Abdulaziz, leading a 48-member delegation of his aides, entered Quincy to officially meet with one of the world's leaders outside of Saudi Arabia. The meeting took place on February the 14th. The most important lines of discussions between Roosevelt and Ibn Saud on board their ship have to date determined the main structure of political ties between the U.S. and Al Saud. The U.S. demanded oil, and Al Saud was in need of security. Following the U.S. economic crisis in the 1930s, Roosevelt was making industrial and economic reforms for 13 years and knew that his country required vast oil resources, especially after the end of World War II, and Saudi Arabia was the country which could meet that requirement. In return, Abdulaziz demanded the U.S. improve his country's security and provide it with the technology needed to make changes on the condition that the U.S. does not interfere in Saudi Arabia's internal affairs, especially religious issues. Saudi Arabia's religious structure, which was based on Wahhabi ideology, was very impervious and fiercely resisted any change or signs from a foreign culture. Sometime after the meeting between Abdulaziz and Roosevelt, during which the alliance between the two countries became stronger, a flow of American advisors in different fields headed to Saudi Arabia to prepare the grounds for the presence of thousands of Americans and their families in the future. Even the presence of these experts was not to the liking of strict Wahhabi leaders, who strongly expressed their displeasure and informed the king of it. The Wahhabi leaders knew that the presence of those advisors would result in changes that are inconsistent with their ideology. Abdulaziz, who had no other way but to invite the American advisors, tried to convince the religious leaders. He cited Prophet Muhammad's cooperation with Christians as an indication legitimizing the presence of the American advisors in Saudi Arabia. With the discovery of new oil fields and extracting more oil, the image of Saudi Arabia began to change, and Saudi rulers, who once lived in deserts, moved to their new palaces. The most important economic income of Saudi Arabia was now from two key sources. One was the annual Hajj pilgrimage that each year attracted millions of Muslims from across the world, and the other one was a precious treasure called oil that lied beneath the sands of this land and made Saudi Arabia one of the richest countries in the world. The middle years of the 20th century marked a period when communist thinking was growing across the world, and at the same time, Arab countries were witnessing a rise in nationalism and pan-Arabism. Both were not to the liking of Saudi authorities and influential clerics, and therefore could not be welcomed in Saudi Arabia. After Gamal Abdel Nasser Hussein came to power in Egypt, and following challenges between him and Muslim Brotherhood supporters, Saudi Arabia opened its doors to the elite of this group so that they can live and work there. Any specialist, from medics to engineers and teachers, was allowed to go to Saudi Arabia. The bulk of those migrants were teachers and university lecturers who left a significant impact on future generations in Saudi Arabia. Based on extreme Wahhabi views, Muslim Brotherhood supporters were also considered strangers, but at least they were Muslims and better than Western infidels. The immigration of Muslim Brotherhood supporters from Egypt, Syria, and Jordan to Saudi Arabia during the 1960s and 70s left a significant impact on the Saudi society in the years that followed. One of those people was Abdullah Yusuf Azam, a scholar who years later played a key role in the formation of militant groups in Islamic countries. In 1973, Arabs and Israel fought a war known as October War. Arab countries were seeking to make up for the defeat they suffered during a six-day war with Israel several years before. Egypt from the south and Syria from the north launched a lightning attack on Israel. Arab countries made gains in the early days of war. That prompted the U.S. to intervene in support of Israel. The largest logistical line was set up to supply Israel with new weapons and change the balance of war, and that assistance turned to be working. In response, Arab countries halted oil exports in support of Egypt and Syria, and as a result, an unprecedented shock pushed oil prices up. The oil prices that did not increase by even a cent in the 1960s suddenly jumped from $3 to $12 a barrel. That was a record price in the market. The economic pressure caused by oil sanctions was so severe that the U.S. was even mulling over military action against Saudi Arabia. But the plan was never implemented after oil sanctions were lifted in March of 1974. Even after the war ended, the world was still grappling with the impacts of the shock caused by high oil prices, but oil-exporting countries gained wealth they had never seen before, and Saudi Arabia naturally was at the top of these countries. The pumping of so much money into Saudi Arabia changed its social image in the years that followed. The most important feature of that change was a tendency to modern Western lifestyle, something which many Wahhabi religious centers in Saudi Arabia were unhappy with. A society which had reacted angrily to the advent of television 10 years before in 1965 was now facing a storm of change. Cities were expanding and new buildings were being constructed, one after another. During these years, many families were making a huge profit from construction across Saudi Arabia, and the Bin Laden family was one of them. The Bin Ladens had come close with the royal family, which helped it sign many contracts to carry out development projects, including the one to develop and renovate Masjid al-Haram, or the Sacred Mosque.
Today I have perfected for you your religion and completed my favor on you and chosen for you Islam as a religion.
Eid Qadir celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of the Holy Prophet, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. Here at IRIB English Radio, congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious and joyous occasion of Eid Qadir. A happy Eid Qadir to all our listeners.
Limelight. Biden is demonstrating with his trip to Saudi Arabia and the occupied Palestinian territories, and with his lack of response to police attacks on press within the United States, that he takes no issue with emboldening attacks on press freedom. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Sam Carliner Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden's West Asia trip shows his disregard for journalists. Stay tuned for more. Joe Biden has made trips to Saudi Arabia and the occupied Palestinian territories, two regimes who have made headlines for murdering journalists. The press in the United States has scrutinized the trip for how it lets the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia off the hook for the high-profile murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Though the Zionist regime has received less scrutiny for its history of targeting journalists, the regime recently faced pushback from international media after its military's targeted assassination of Shirin Abu Aghele, a trailblazing Palestinian journalist for Al Jazeera and an American citizen. This trip demonstrates that while officials of the Biden administration often pay lip service in support of press freedom, they will let governments off the hook for high-profile murders of journalists if those regimes help the U.S. maintain regional influence. It may be hard for some to admit that the U.S. government disregards press freedom in order to maintain international power. But for those of Americans who have been following the trial of Julian Assange, it comes as no surprise. The U.S. government has waged a campaign to silence and torture Australian journalist and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange ever since he published evidence of U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan in 2010. These attacks began during the Obama administration and escalated dramatically under the Trump administration. Infamous for its contempt for press freedom, the Trump administration indicted Assange on never-before-seen charges for publishing and began the process to extradite Assange from the UK, where he is currently imprisoned, to the United States to be tried under the Espionage Act. Even though just about every major human rights and press freedom NGO, as well as leading newspaper editorial boards, have warned that extradition would set a dangerous precedent against international press freedom and the First Amendment in the U.S., the Biden administration has continued to pursue extradition. This is a move that even Obama, whose administration waged a war on whistleblowers, chose not to make due to its implications for press freedom. Extradition would set the precedent that any journalist can be punished by the U.S. government for publishing truthful information that embarrasses the United States regime. UK Home Secretary Priti Patel has approved extradition, and Assange's legal team has filed its High Court appeal to stop the extradition. Time is running out for journalists in the U.S. to speak up before this attack on their rights is finalized. The actions of both Trump and Biden towards the press have made it much more dangerous to be a journalist within the United States. During the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020, police across the country targeted journalists, injuring and arresting hundreds of reporters. Though this large-scale targeting of press occurred during Trump's presidency, similar police attacks on journalists recently took place during protests for rights of other things last month. Rather than address this violence from government forces against the press, Biden urged protesters not to be violent. Biden is demonstrating with his trip to Saudi Arabia and occupied Palestinian territories, and with his lack of response to police attacks on press within the United States, that he takes no issue with emboldening attacks on press freedom. Since the Biden administration cannot be counted on to defend the rights of journalists as a principle, it is essential for the public to become louder and more organized in support of press freedom. In order for such public demands to grow, journalists must do a better job showing solidarity with colleagues, especially Julian Assange, whose persecution has been enabled by silence from journalists within the United States. U.S. news outlets must clarify to the public the stakes of an extradition of Julian Assange. For too long, many journalists in the U.S. have been far too passive as the U.S. government enables violence and repression against the press. Now is the time for Americans to fight these attacks, and that fight depends on freedom for Julian Assange.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
U.S. President Joe Biden touched down in West Asia. Meanwhile, it has emerged that his administration is considering lifting the ban on the sale of offensive weapons to Saudi Arabia. However, reports say the final decision over the issue is expected to hinge on whether Riyadh makes progress towards ending the war in neighboring Yemen.
This decision, supposedly hinging on whether or not Saudi Arabia makes sufficient political progress towards a negotiated solution with Yemen, as articulated, is in fact absurd. It's completely backwards. Rather than forcing the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to the negotiating table, what it does instead is, of course, fortifies the lethality of the Saudi military, and it also, as well, gives it increased leverage at the bargaining table.
According to media reports, senior Saudi officials pressed their U.S. counterparts to scrap a policy of selling only defensive arms to the Persian Gulf Kingdom in several meetings in Riyadh and Washington in recent months. In February 2021, Biden said he was ending support for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, a policy that included a ban on the sales of offensive weapons. But it was later revealed that U.S. contractors were still maintaining Saudi warplanes that were bombing Yemen. And the Biden administration approved the sale of air-to-air missiles to Saudi Arabia in November 2021.
Therefore, if the United States actually seeks to end the genocidal war against the people of Yemen, this decision to continue offensive arms sales such as precision-guided munitions to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia is the exact opposite of what it should in fact be doing.
That's why one of Biden's main objectives will be to get Riyadh to increase cooperation with Israel. Although full normalization is not expected, Saudi Arabia could take a step in that direction by allowing Israeli flights in its airspace or by quietly increasing military cooperation to counter Iran. While in Israel, talk of military support for the regime was a priority for Biden. At home, any move to rescind restrictions on offensive weapons is sure to draw opposition in Congress, including from Biden's fellow Democrats and opposition Republicans who have been vocal critics of Saudi Arabia. However, the U.S. president is stuck between a rock and a hard place. If it does not yield to providing Saudi Arabia with more weapons, the kingdom may not have an appetite to reset relations with the U.S. at this point in time. Let's not forget, as a presidential candidate, Biden denounced Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Yet, Biden's approach has softened since the start of the Ukraine war, which has prompted the United States and other Western countries to appeal to Saudi Arabia to pump more oil to offset the loss of Russian supplies.
Well, you know, due to U.S.-sponsored sanctions on some of the world's largest oil producers, Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, President Biden is facing a crisis that is largely of his own making and that of the United States. Therefore, he comes to the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia essentially as a supplicant with his hand outstretched to plead for increased oil production. President Biden, unfortunately, does not have any vision or plan for the Middle East.
The Saudi regime is considered one of the most despotic regimes in the West Asia region, which routinely violates the rights of dissidents. It has engaged in a brutal war against Yemen, which has killed thousands of people, including countless women and children.
U.S. President Joe Biden visited Israel to once again express Washington's unconditional support for the Israeli regime. This is his first trip to the region since taking office. Biden's visit to Israel follows the collapse of a coalition-led regime headed by Naftali Bennett. Biden opened his visit by offering anxious Israeli leaders strong reassurances of his determination to stop Iran's nuclear energy program, saying he'd be willing to use force as a last resort. He said it would not remove Iran's Islamic Revolution Guard Corps from the U.S. list of so-called terrorist organizations, even if that meant wrecking the Iranian nuclear deal for good. Biden and Israel's Prime Minister Lapid have signed a so-called security declaration affirming their united front against Iran.
So I would not qualify this joint declaration as anything but some kind of posturing. Joe Biden, as any U.S. president before him since 1967, has basically been beholden to Zionist interest, and he cannot hold any kind of discourse which deviates from this notion that Israeli national interest and U.S. national interest are one and the same.
Biden made reviving the Iran nuclear deal, brokered by Barack Obama in 2015 and abandoned by Donald Trump in 2018, a key priority as he entered office. Biden said Trump made a gigantic mistake by withdrawing the U.S. from the Iran nuclear deal. But talks for the U.S. to re-enter the deal have stalled as Biden has stuck to his predecessor's tactics, piling up on the sanctions and refraining from giving guarantees that Washington would not abandon the deal again.
Despite all measures of good faith and all efforts and all kind of flexibility from the Republic, the Islamic Republic of Iran, the United States under Joe Biden has not only maintained the maximum pressure doctrine sanction regime installed by Trump, but has failed to lift the sanctions that were the object of negotiation back in 2015, and should I say, has gone out of its way to show really bad intent in the context of the negotiation.
Joe Biden has vowed to boost Washington's military support for Tel Aviv. Iran says U.S. President Joe Biden's visit to the Middle East will not bring security for the occupying regime. President Ebrahim Raisi said if the visits by American officials to the region are intended to reinforce the Zionist regime's position and provide impetus to the normalization process, the efforts are bound to fail. Tehran has also slammed the U.S. for keeping up unconditional support for Israel. Biden is also following up on Washington's agenda of enabling normalization between Arab states and Israel, which is aimed at pushing the Palestinian cause to the sidelines. Upon disembarking from U.S. Air Force One, which arrived at Ben Gurion Airport, Biden said he did not think a Palestinian state was likely to happen in the near future. Just as Biden was visiting Israel, the regime's military bulldozers began plowing lands belonging to four Palestinian villages between Ramallah and Nablus. Israeli settlements in the West Bank, which house more than 600,000 settlers, are viewed by Palestinians as a major obstacle to their future state and lasting peace between Jews and Palestinians. Israeli rights group B'Tselem says the U.S. government should be held accountable for the Israeli regime's violations. Leader of Lebanon's resistance movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, said a lot of hope and illusions are built around this visit. But the United States of today is not the same as it was in 2003 and 2006. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stated that Biden's remark upon arrival in Tel Aviv emphasizes support for the Israeli regime.
The Israeli, on the other hand, are desperate to enroll Arab states, and Saudi Arabia is the master prize, which is why we've seen all this courtship going on. Mostly on at the behest of Tel Aviv, trying to lure the crown prince to sign some kind of alliance. And in this respect, this joint declaration, as Joe Biden sets out to visit the officially the GCC, but let's not make any mistake about it, to meet Mohammed bin Salman on the sideline of this forum, he's aimed at trying to tell him that his interest, his security interest, lies with Tel Aviv. This remains to be seen.
It's now widely believed that Biden's much-hyped visit to Israel and Saudi Arabia is doomed to fail and will not bring any substantial change to the realities of the region.
The devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout continue to take a toll on the world and provide ample reason to reconsider where taxpayers' money is being spent. Several countries have even come to the conclusion that their budget is better off being spent where it can potentially ameliorate the economic pressure on their citizens. In the U.S., however, while such reassessments are long overdue along with the trillions of dollars Congress and successive administrations have lavished on the Pentagon, lawmakers have decided to once again shower the Pentagon with cash, even more than what it asked for. Interestingly enough, this comes while the massive U.S. arsenal and fighting force deployed worldwide have proven to be powerless against grave, non-military threats to national security. Gas prices in the U.S. are at an all-time high. Rent prices have set records for the last 13 months straight. Inflation is increasing so sharply that even the cost of basic utilities has risen by nearly 30% in the last 12 months. There are growing fears that the economy is poised to fall into recession. And now, at a time when Americans are fighting to keep roofs over their heads and feed their families, Congress's plan is to authorize a record-setting $838.8 billion in spending to the Pentagon, nearly $40 billion more than what the military asked for.
American taxpayers should be angry. They are angry. Many are not only angry, they are incensed, and they are protesting. But unfortunately, too many elected representatives in this country aren't listening to their constituents. They're listening to the representatives and the lobbyists of the military-industrial complex, such as Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, Boeing, and General Electric. So when you have those companies and so many others that are pouring millions and millions and millions of dollars into the political campaigns of members of Congress and members of the Senate and the president, when they are pouring millions of dollars into their political campaigns, when they spend just an inordinate amount of time on Capitol Hill lobbying for their interests, then you're going to wind up with policies and programs that are sending money to the Pentagon instead of sending money into states for schools and retirement programs and the other types of social welfare programs and that are needed in this country.
The U.S. Congress is on track to give the Pentagon $37 billion more than what the military asked for. And this comes while Congress could use this money to pay for a variety of things Americans desperately need right now, like school lunches, affordable housing, and utility assistance programs. Even just lowering taxes by that amount or giving this money directly to the American people could put more than $100 in the pocket of every single American at a time when they desperately need it. Not only would spending in such ways benefit the individuals and communities that receive them, it would also help revitalize the U.S. economy and make it more equitable to boot. As has been well documented, defense spending is one of the least economically productive ways the government can spend its money. Spending on education, healthcare, and lowering taxes, for example, have all been shown to create more and higher-paying jobs. So why is Congress poised to give government contractors the biggest taxpayer-funded payday they've ever received, despite the heavy economic implications that the move has on the country?
Well, the reason that the United States government is pursuing war strategies is because America is still an imperial hegemon. And so you have people like Tony Blinken and Avril Haines, Samantha Power, Jake Sullivan, Victoria Nuland that are influencing decision makers in policy to try to start fights with Russia, try to start conflicts with China, start to continue to try to start conflicts with Iran to justify this immense military spending.
Pentagon contractors invest heavily in efforts to get more taxpayer money. They've spread their influence and money around the lobbyists, PR firms, and think tanks to ensure that the money is funneled in their way. In short, this is the military-industrial complex, and it is working overtime to raise the Pentagon budget at taxpayers' expense. And while much of Washington is on the racket and will also profit from this wasteful government spending, it's Americans struggling to keep the lights on who will pay the price. President Biden has almost unlimited ways of communicating with the world, but he opted to pen an article posted online Saturday night by the Washington Post to defend his pending West Asia trip in light of the controversies around it. In the piece, he speaks about many issues, including further integrating Israel into the region, Washington's ties with Riyadh, the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the Iran nuclear deal, and more. While most of the matters mentioned in the article are centered around West Asia, they also seem to share another point. The U.S. itself is either complicit in or directly responsible for the very issues it claims that it is trying to solve.
The U.S. Lies through its teeth without stopping a minute. We've seen the debates and discussions about the comprehensive agreement with Iran, which they had promised to renegotiate, and they seem not to be negotiating in good faith. They're trying to paint themselves as innocent, which of course they are not. And they just had a recent rebuff at the G20 meeting in Indonesia, where Mr. Blinken refused to sit down with the leaders of all these states.
Saudi Arabia, infamous for its violations of human rights and under widespread criticism for its bloody war on Yemen, as well as the killing of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi, is a focal point of Biden's West Asia tour. But despite this, the U.S. president's framing of the Saudi relationship appeared particularly defensive. During his election campaign, Biden had pledged of making Saudi Arabia a pariah for its crime. But now he has ironically claimed that ties with Riyadh helped promote the U.S.'s foreign policy ambitions. Similar to the other issues, the U.S. president also tried to take fault away from his administration in regard to the Iran nuclear program file by putting the blame on Iran. Biden also stated his readiness to further pressure Tehran despite Tehran's readiness to return to the deal, and this too sheds light on the U.S.'s ironical foreign policy. One of the main purposes of Joe Biden's visit is the salt deepening of Israel's integration in the region and moving forwards with the Abraham Accords, which is the pillar of normalization deals with Israel. But the latter has raised questions regarding Biden's foreign policies, as Israel itself seems to be the source of the problem in the region, from its atrocities against Palestinians to its continuous attacks on Syria and its repeated threats against Iran. In the op-ed piece, President Biden says the U.S. helped end the 2021 war on Gaza, but fails to condemn Israel for its atrocities and violation of Palestinian rights. Biden also proudly mentions the U.S.'s $4 billion support of Israel. But what does all this demonstrate about the U.S.'s stance on Palestinians who have been subject to Israeli brutality for years now?
Well, the issue of the United States and Israel is a burning issue right now, and the U.S. has acted in a hypocritical way where Russia has attacked special military operation in Ukraine to denazify it, and we know what Nazis are. So, and yet, so the U.S. has spent $40 or $60 billion arming these countries, letting all those Ukrainian youth be killed who were forced into fighting Russia. And yet, with respect to Gaza, 8 months earlier, Israel unleashed a horrible attack on Gaza, and the U.S. hummed and hawed, tried to sort of say, maybe we'll calm things down. They didn't spend $40 billion to arm the resistance against Israel. And that is a term which I call tongue-in-cheek. I don't know whether you know the term. It's sort of a sarcastic term because obviously the U.S. is not going to do that, but it's related to empire.
The U.S.'s one-sided stance on Israel is also clearly demonstrated in the Shirin Abu Akleh case, where it stopped short of reaching a definitive conclusion in her killing by Israeli troops, while all other investigations reached the conclusion that the regime troops did in fact murder her. Now, despite Israeli crimes, Washington seeks not only to integrate the regime further into the region, but also aims to advance its plans to upgrade defense cooperation between Israel and Arabs in the light of the Abraham Accords. And all this raises the question of whether the U.S. truly seeks justice and advocates for human rights, or it only claims to do so in order to move forward with its agenda.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
From the very outset of its peaceful nuclear energy program, the Islamic Republic has offered to cooperate in this vital field with neighboring Muslim states and share the fruits of its successes for development in various sectors in order to break the stranglehold of the big, dangerously nuclear-armed powers, says Kayhan, international staff writer, in an article published under the heading "Iran and Iraq to Enter Peaceful Nuclear Cooperation." Stay tuned for more. From the very outset of its peaceful nuclear energy program, the Islamic Republic of Iran has offered to cooperate in this vital field with neighboring Muslim states and share the fruits of its successes for development in various sectors in order to break the stranglehold of the big, dangerously nuclear-armed powers. None, however, summoned up the courage to accept Iran's offer because of their fears of the U.S. and its politicization of Tehran's peaceful IAEA-certified nuclear projects, although they knew that cooperation with the Islamic Republic was to their benefit and in the interest of regional stability.